when I saw the footage come back after we directed the interviews, we were stunned by the cinematic brilliance of it, that we knew that we had to take at least 8 months to really take the time, put together this documentary, and not just do a couple episodes of it.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
And this is the Electronic Intifada podcast. This is episode number 12. I'm your host, Nora Barrows-Friedman, with my co-host, Asa Winstanley. Asa, how are you doing right now? It's in the thrust of the UK elections. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm great. Thanks, Nora. It's a crazy time, really, the elections. They are really reviving the Labour anti-Semitism smear quite substantially. And it's there's only a few weeks left to go, and I have so many stories. I mean, our readers will know that one of the main beats I've had for the last 4 years really is this issue, and how fabricated and exaggerated claims of anti-Semitism have really plagued the Labour Party. And in the course of that, I've only been able to tell half the story, really. There's so many leads that I haven't been able to really follow up on, or haven't had time to get around to, you know. And it's really frustrating to me to think that this issue is being used to really attack the Labour Party and could really cost the Labour Party this election, you know, potentially.
And it's been such a coordinated and sustained smear campaign. You'd think that, you know, they would get tired of trotting out these old smears, but they don't. They just keep doing it.
They don't, because unfortunately the Labour leadership has really given way to it, you know, and they kind of sent blood in that way. And once they go on the attack and draw proverbial blood, then they're going to keep on doing it when they see there's a retreat. And it just leaves Labour Party open up to this issue being brought out time and time again. And it just makes Labour Party's got quite good policies in its manifesto. You know, there's some moderately sensible stuff there about, you know, stuff that's really common sense, really, keeping the NHS in public ownership, renationalising certain basic companies and so forth. But this election especially has been hard for Labour, because every time they bring out one of these policies, it seems there's a new revival of this smear campaign. And it's made it really difficult to break. And I think it has. I mean, people have sometimes, Labour activists have kind of said, oh, well, we should just ignore these smears and we should just sort of carry on with what we're doing, and, you know, people don't actually believe it or don't actually care. But there is some polling to indicate that as many as 40% of the British public think that either that Jeremy Corbyn's an anti-Semite, or that, you know, the party has some sort of issue there with anti-Semitism. And I think it is beginning to break through to the mainstream, because in terms of people believing it, because it feeds into a wider narrative about Corbyn being a so-called extremist and so forth. So, we'll have to wait and see what happens.
I mean, it just reminds me of, like, the targeted attacks that are still going on against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. And, you know, any person publicly, politician or, you know, leader of any movement who dares to speak up for Palestinian rights, they're automatically labeled an anti-Semite. And the evidence is the accusation. And that's all they really need.
Yes, exactly.
And that's it's frightening.
Yeah, it's a really disgusting line. You know, it's this really self-fulfilling logic that they just start off on the premise that the left is anti-Semitic, and that the accusation itself is evidence.
Right.
And if you deny this so-called evidence, then you too are an anti-Semite. So we've seen this on both sides of the Atlantic, and I think it's only going to ramp up in the US, actually.
Absolutely.
If Bernie does win the nomination, you know, if he does win the primaries, which for all his limitations, I do hope he does.
Yeah.
I think that we will see Labour anti-Semitism cross the Atlantic Ocean and become Democratic Party anti-Semitism. And as you've said, it's already started, you know. They started on Ilhan Omar and the rest of the squad and so on and so forth. I mean, you may say, you know, that it'd be harder against Bernie Sanders because he's Jewish himself. But I don't think that's going to be an issue for them, because the real issue of anti-Semitism is not, they don't actually care about that.
Right.
No, it's just using it. Right. Anti-Semitism as a smear is not what it used to be, as Jonathan Shanza said from the Foundation of Defense for Defense of Democracy.
That's right. Yeah. Lamenting. Lamenting that it wasn't.
Yeah, lamenting it. And so it's really in that film, that Undercover Al Jazeera film, it's really stunning to think of that quote, because it shows that in private, they do consider it a smear.
Yeah.
You know, they wouldn't say it in public. And it's reached a stage in the Labour Party now whereby if you say it's a smear, that in itself is anti-Semitic.
Right.
So if you say anti-Semitism is a smear, then you're an anti-Semite too. Well, you know, the Israel lobby itself says that, you know. So it's, it's pretty stunning, really. It's pretty staggering stuff.
Well, thank you for covering all of that, as you do for the Electronic Intifada and other outlets. I know that you've been on some television programs talking about all of this, and you've been doing some of the research. Tell us a little bit about what you've been up to lately.
Yeah, I got invited on a couple of TV programs the last week or so. Doesn't happen that often, unfortunately.
Surprising.
I do kind of enjoy it. Yeah, right. of course, these were not British TV channels. I don't think that would ever happen. So Al Jazeera Arabic invited me on to speak via translator. They have really excellent simultaneous translation on Al Jazeera Arabic when you appear as a non-Arabic speaking pundit. I do have what I like to call falafel sandwich Arabic, but it's certainly not good enough to go on Al Jazeera Arabic and discuss political issues. They invited me on a Saturday afternoon, and I kind of really didn't want to do it because I like my weekends.
Yeah.
But I did go on in the end, and it was quite good. They asked me about the European Court of Justice's recent ruling about labeling settlement produce.
Right.
So produce made in illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank, sold in European supermarkets, has to be labeled as such. It can't be labeled made in Israel. That was good. So I argued that it's going to be difficult for Israel to separate in this way, and that it raises the question of a wider boycott and so forth. And then I was on TRT World as well, which is kind of like, I learned, is like Turkey's Al Jazeera English. I was on it once years ago, and I was then actually talking about Labour, so-called Labour anti-Semitism in 2016, and they got me on head-to-head, this sort of obnoxious moron from some crappy liberal website that nobody reads. He was just trying to say how Labour was anti-Semitic and blah, blah, blah. And this was at the beginning of the so-called Labour anti-Semitism crisis. And I just laid into the guy. It was weird, though, because I don't think the producers didn't do a very good job then, because they didn't tell me it was going to be a head-to-head debate and that I'd be, be sort of, say, one person saying Labour is anti-Semitic and one person isn't. That kind of thing. And the guy just went for me personally, so I laid into him. I think I did quite well. But the clip's still up there. But no, this was different. So it was much better. They just got me on to talk as one of two pundits about the latest, you know, ridiculous declaration by the American administration about how settlements are great and wonderful and there's no illegality there. yeah, so that was good. I was a pundit sort of talking into a camera, and the other guy in Istanbul was actually Samuel Aryan.
Oh, no kidding.
Former political prisoner, you know, kept for years in American dungeons. So it would be nice to actually meet the guy. I heard over the earpiece Samuel Aryan, and I thought, oh, maybe it's like one of his sons or cousins or something. But no, later on I saw it was the very same Samuel Aryan. And so it was nice to kind of talk with again, you know, be one of two pundits, and we were both in agreement basically talking along the same sort of line. So yeah, it was good. So yeah, it's nice to go on TV, I guess.
Yeah. Every once in a while, when there's an opening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
even it doesn't happen for us.
No.
Anywhere near enough. Yeah, it would be good to see that more. Noah, I just read this piece of yours about what happened at the Canadian University.
Ah, yes.
The JDL, the so-called Jewish Defense League, this right. Extremist Zionist organization, you know, known for its extreme violence in the 70s and 80s, even carried out bombing campaigns in New York and Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
The JDL has been a kind of intermittent beat of mine from time to time, so I'm always a bit alarmed to see them cropping up again. So can you tell us a bit about
I think we all are. Yeah, I mean, here's an actual like terrorist organization that has been banned in the U.S. And is allowed to operate out in the open in Canada for whatever reason. I mean, you know, Canada has a lot of the same policies, obviously, towards Palestinians that the U.S. does, and in some cases, like allowing the JDL to you know form and grow and walk onto campuses and incite violence and actually assault, threaten, and yell racial slurs at protesters. Canada hasn't you know seen anything wrong with that. So what happened was there was a very far right group called Herut Canada, which brought this, you know, this group of Israeli soldiers to campus. They're part of a group called Reservists on Duty, and we've covered them before. They're obviously very Zionist, very right wing, very pro you know Israeli military. They're Israeli soldiers themselves, and they, you know, they come to campuses all over North America in what can really just be described as like recruitment ploys.
Right.
And which is illegal for a foreign military to, you know, try and recruit on, you know, at least in Canada.
Right.
So they were doing this event on campus. Obviously, Palestine solidarity protesters, a lot of them Palestinians, you know, planned a protest to counter their, you know, very violent narrative. And they got word that the JDL Canada was going to show up. And JDL Canada did. And they immediately started inciting, you know, their own members to punch and strangle and actually knocked one of the protesters out. One protester was hit in the back of the head, allegedly by a JDL member, taken to the hospital. And, you know, and then we have like Mayor Weinstein, who's the head of the JDL Canada, who was actually banned from York University campus at one point earlier this year. He was there inciting his minions to threaten and intimidate and carry out these violent assaults against protesters. And he actually like filmed himself there saying that the JDL was here to, you know, to basically like
right,
put these protesters in their place.
Yeah, and in your article about this, I saw some really blatant comments that some of these JDL supporters had made.
They were admitting to it. Yeah, they're admitting to it. And instead of, you know, coming to the defense of the students who were protesting,
knocking people out with a flagpole for 10 minutes and stuff like that.
Instead of, you know, not just the university administration, but politicians coming to the defense of the protesters who were being assaulted by this violent gang of thugs, they instead, you know, took the JDL at their word, who claimed that the protesters were anti-Semites. Of course, we see this smear over and over again. And not just the Toronto mayor, but Premier Doug Ford and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau all tweeted basically in support of the JDL.
Justin, I love blackface Trudeau.
That's right.
The guy really, really loves blackface. Like, seriously. Like, how he couldn't even remember how many times that he wore blackface.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And the York University administration has so far not done anything. You know, so students are asking the administration to take responsibility for allowing this terrorist organization on campus to assault protesters. And, you know, it just kind of shows... It shows the true face of, you know, Canadian politicians' sentiment towards Palestinians and people who support their rights. So, you can check that out.
Yeah, read Nora's article. It's great. It's up on EI. It's a top story on EI, I think, today, Wednesday, 27th of November. It's the most recent story. Have a read of it. I found this really resonated actually with what's going on in the UK, really, just in terms of the political response to it. Not in terms of the JDL exactly, because although there is a JDL UK, and I did cover it in some detail a few years ago, because there was an assault, they carried out an assault, quite a serious assault against a Palestinian literature festival of all things.
I remember that,
these two weirdos, you know, it literally, I mean, this so-called JDL UK is really just a few weirdos, thankfully. I think the JDL Canada is more of a serious and organized group, to say nothing of the JDL in France, which is really quite insidious. But it reminded me that... what happened in this Canadian university, the way that the Prime Minister, politicians from the Prime Minister downwards responded to it, really struck me as similar to what's going on here, because there was no question of, or let's find out the facts of what happened and then respond accordingly. It was literally, they saw the word anti-Semitism, regardless of who it comes from. The accusation comes from an extremist terrorist group in this case. But that doesn't matter. The word anti-Semitism is raised, and just all critical faculties just go out the window. There's no need for automatic evidence. Yeah, like you said, like the allegation itself constitutes the evidence.
That's right.
It's completely insane. He saw this accusation. You know, Adam Milstein, this multi-millionaire convicted Israeli-American felon, convicted of tax dodging, with deep ties to the Israeli state and the Israel's semi-covert anti-BDS agency, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, Adam Milstein tweeted, disgusting, you know, what he tweeted was really disgusting. It was a pure fabrication. And he just tweeted a video, and he said that the Palestinian protesters were saying anti-Semitic chants. And the video didn't support that whatsoever.
There has been no video evidence to support that. And you know, when you... If you've ever
gone to a...
And
there's no evidence of it, and the Prime Minister is believing it anyway.
Right.
Right? It's insane. And that's what goes on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just... You know, the fact, so Adam Milstein and the Jerusalem Post and a bunch of other Zionist right-wing tweeters... were claiming that the Palestinian protesters at York in Toronto were chanting "Intifada, Intifada, go back to the ovens," right? Which there's no evidence to support that happened. You can see all of the, I mean, there's literally dozens of videos from this event, and not one shows that. And, you know, if you've ever gone to a protest, you know that the best chants are the ones that rhyme or that have like a certain, you know, cadence, or, you know, there's like a melody of syllables, you know what I mean? That there's no way that chant would have, because the Palestinian protesters there are not anti-Semitic. They are not calling for the, you know, destruction of the Jewish people or the Jewish religion. They were calling for the accountability of the Israeli military, which was there on their campus. And that, you know,
it's like the facts don't matter to these people it's like even in getting into this discussion that we're having now, we're having to say, well, actually the Palestinians were not anti-Semitic.
Right.
And this is the problem that Jeremy Corbyn has got into, right? Yeah. All he's had to say is, all he's said for the last 4 years, I'm not anti-Semitic, you know, Labour is not an anti-Semitic party. We condemn anti-Semitism, etc., etc., etc. All people are hearing, the normal voter, is anti-Semitism. They may not understand all the ins and outs of it, or even understand the obsession with it, but all they're hearing is anti-Semitism, anti-Semitism, anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
So it just carries it on, you know? And that's why they keep doing this, because these spineless politicians like Justin Blackface Trudeau just instantly believe it and indulge in these fantasies and conspiracy theories. It's really infuriating.
Yeah, to say the least. But we have just a minute left before we go into this wonderful interview that we did recently with Abby Martin. She's a journalist, filmmaker, and producer and director of her latest documentary, which is called Gaza Fights for Freedom. And we interviewed her right before this latest round of attacks by Israel on Gaza. And so, you know, it was, I think it's important to have her on and kind of contextualize the, you know, this greater situation that Gaza is in. But we can talk for a few minutes about what did happen in Gaza in early, mid-November. According to our own Maureen Claire Murphy, who reported a lot about what was happening in Gaza as it was happening, Gaza's health ministry stated on November 14th that Israeli forces killed 34 Palestinians during the fighting, which was about 48 hours of violence. Nearly half of those 34 Palestinians killed are civilians, including 8 children and 3 women, including 3 members of the Ayad family, among them a 7-year-old child, who were killed as they were on a motorcycle in front of their Gaza City home on Wednesday, November 13th. So, Asa, you know, how do we look at this, you know, this 48 hours of bombings by the Israeli military on Gaza's population? You know, what was going through your mind as this was all happening a couple weeks ago?
Yeah, it was fully sickening just how blatantly Israel began this particular, you know, outbreak of violence against the Palestinian population. I think that, I mean, people are always trying to read the runes and say, oh, well, it was because of this particular political development, and maybe Benjamin Netanyahu was trying to distract attention from, you know, these fraud proceedings and, you know, an upcoming possibility of a third election and so on and so forth, trying to look like a hard man to Israeli voters and so on. People, you know, and I those kind of divinations, I don't like them, because it we're missing the big picture, which is that 2 million people, mostly refugees, are being kept in the world's largest open air prison, just subjected to occasional bouts of extreme violence and purges, really, by the Israeli government, just for the crime of being born as a Palestinian, simply for not being Jewish. in what they perceive to be a Jewish state. You know, that Gaza is really is still fully occupied, still fully under siege, and Israel has the full responsibility for that. And until we see the end of occupation, full equality for Palestinians, and return of the refugees, the price of Zionism is these periodic massacres against Palestinian people, and that's the political reality. And yeah. It's going to continue that way.
As our colleague Omar Karmi wrote, he said, why is Israel, you know, something like, why is Israel bombing Gaza again? Because it can.
Yeah.
And that's
because there's no consequences for it.
Right. Yeah. Well, we will link to all of the latest news on Gaza, all of our latest blog posts, and of course, Abby Martin's film that we're going to be talking about right now, Gaza Fights for Freedom. Let's take a short musical break, and we'll be right back with Abby Martin. Joining us to talk about her film, Gaza Fights for Freedom, is our friend, the journalist Abby Martin. Abby, thanks so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
It's a great honor to be on. Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start by talking about how the film came to be made. You're the host of the late, great show Breaking the Set on RT America until 2015. And since then, you're the host of The Empire Files. And on both shows, you've covered the effects of Western imperialism and confronted the U.S. war machine's reign of terror across the world. But what brought you to focus on Palestine and the liberation struggle for Palestinians, and specifically what's been happening in Gaza over the course of the Great March of Return, which began in March of 2018?
Right. Well, Nora, you actually played a role in that. I remember back when I was living in Oakland, I saw a lecture from you about the architecture of oppression. You know, I've always been interested in the Palestinian cause, considering that they've always been conflated with terrorists in the wake of 9/11, even were blamed in part for 9/11. You know, you see kind of ad nauseum that footage of quote unquote Palestinians dancing in the streets. You had right wing ideologues on TV that morning advocating the invasion of Gaza. And Netanyahu, of course, saying now you have your own war on terror, just like we do, and you can finally experience, you know, what Israelis go through on a daily basis. So it's always been in the back of my mind. But I think once I started working at Russia Today and working alongside multiple Palestinians who constantly had to check in with their families every time Israel would go on a bombing campaign in Gaza. So, you know, Operation Pillar of Cloud, I think, was the first time that I was really shocked and horrified by the fact that my colleagues were literally seeing if their family members were alive or dead on a daily basis, and could not get in touch with their uncles and cousins that resided in Gaza. Of course, the flotilla massacre, I think, was a time when it really shook a lot of people to the media distortion. I mean, how could you possibly say that that was, you know, righteous? And I'll just never forget CNN and all these channels just showing like the propaganda side circling the people trying to hit the commandos that had just massacred 9 or 10 people on board, circling like the people who were holding tables and chairs trying to fend them off, saying, look, they have weapons. And then fast forward to, again, at RT when Operation Pillar of Cloud was going on and Israeli forces bombed the Al Sharok journalist tower, and the leg of an RT cameraman was blown off. And Avita Lobovich, the IDF spokesperson, basically when RT prompted Israel for a response of why they targeted a journalist tower when they knew the journalists were inside the building, Avita Lobovich said, of course we knew there were journalists inside the building. Everyone in Gaza is a Hamas target, and RT has taken a side in coverage of this conflict. And that was at a time when I was kind of, you know, really going hard every day talking about the war crimes that were being committed. So I realized then that, you know, they would really stop at nothing, and they would go to great lengths to, you know, commit atrocities and just absolve themselves of them. But fast forward to when I was able to finally go to the West Bank with my partner, Mike Preisner, who produces the show Empire Files with me, and just seeing the occupation firsthand. I mean, you realize that the atomization of the West Bank, there's no hope for a two-state solution. And understanding that reality by being on the ground, understanding the reality of settler terrorism, you know, being able to visit the Dawabsha family and stuff like that. And so we wanted to get into Gaza. We had all the proper credentials, filled out all the right paperwork. And we were told by Ron Paz, the underling of Netanyahu with the Foreign Press Office, that we were propagandists and denied outright, basically banned for life. And told that I was an Iranian agent, which I was, you know, I'm used to being called a Russian agent and a Venezuelan agent. So I was like, where the hell is this coming from?
I'm sorry, what? Repeat that last bit. Like they formally said that to you in a letter, that you were an Iranian agent.
Yes. And
that's
it was
bizarre.
Quite scary.
On what basis?
Yeah. I think because Telesur had diplomatic relations with Iran, and so they kind of, you know, perform some mental gymnastics to basically say I was therefore an Iranian agent.
I see.
Pretty incredible. Scary.
It's a pretty huge stretch.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, a year and a half later, the Great March of Return sparked off, and I Skyped in with the Council of International Relations there in Gaza to kind of just discuss Western media coverage. And that's when this collaboration arose out of that discussion with about 30 Gaza journalists. And we talked about how we should do an Empire Files series on the Great March to do the story justice, because, of course, as we know, the corporate media was just abhorrent in their coverage of it and distorting everything. And the only time that they covered it was when 60 people were mowed down in cold blood. And, of course, it was done with the passive voice, excused as just clashes happened. And when I saw the footage come back after we directed the interviews, we were stunned by the cinematic brilliance of it, that we knew that we had to take at least 8 months to really take the time, put together this documentary, and not just do a couple episodes of it.
So tell us about the photojournalists who shot the footage, who you worked with, and the challenges that they faced over, you know, these long months of covering these protests every Friday.
Sure. Well, I'll start by saying that we actually had to redact our co-producer's name. This was our, you know, this is the person I was most in contact with every single day for 8 months straight, doing all the field production, getting me all the footage, you know, really available, really impassioned and involved in the project. He had to just remove his name at the end of the day from the film because he said he did not want any reason for Israel to retaliate against him. And he wanted to eventually be able to leave Gaza. And that just really struck me. It just struck me at my core, because it's just something that you don't think about. And the fact that he can't get the accolades for being involved in a project like this because he's just scared. It's sick. But Asma Tia Hamad, the female photojournalist, I was so incredibly stunned and inspired by the fact that a female was, the counterpart to Muaz Maza, who was the one really going out there in the march every single Friday, running toward the bullets. You know, I mean, you see literally multiple times in this footage of people getting shot, and he runs toward the scene. It's courage that's really unmatched, I think, by anyone else that I know in this field of work. And I think that really just speaks to how strong Palestinian journalists are. I mean, whenever there's something going on in Gaza, they're the first on the front lines to run out there in the line of danger every single time to show the truth and to expose what's going on. But working with them was incredible. Muaz wishes that he could be on tour with us. I talked to him just the other day, and he was just like, following all the news coverage very closely, and you know, he's just really excited about the project. He thinks it turns out really well, and he's really happy that we kind of did justice to his photojournalism, because it's absolutely brilliant. The slow motion steady cam work that they did, the drone work, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, it's unlike really anything that I've seen presented even in documentary form, and it really puts you inside these protests that I've never really experienced before, kind of akin to, you know, anyone who's seen like Samsara, Baraka, or it's really brilliant, brilliant work.
Yeah.
And it was an incredibly inspiring experience to work with both of them over the course of these months.
So the film is called Gaza Fights for Freedom, and our listeners can watch it by renting it on Vimeo, renting it or buying it on Vimeo. And it's a really wonderful film. Could you talk a little bit about how it worked logistically to make this film? Because you've talked about the challenges that the Palestinian videographers had in shooting this film, you know, the threat, literal threats to their lives. Mm-hmm. And as we've just learned, the threat to the well-being of your co-producer, whose name, you know, must remain redacted. How did it work on a day-to-day basis making this film with you? You weren't allowed to go in. How did that work? Talk a little bit about the logistics of that. It must have been a really tough challenge.
It was, and I think the toughest challenge, especially being, you know, sitting as a privileged American and with electricity, and just saying, hey, can you get this footage over? And they're like, yeah, when we have electricity, you know, or like,
yeah, you know? Right. Because like we, this is something that hits me right. as well a lot sometimes is that we read about this stuff. Oh, Gaza has only so many, you know, a few hours of electricity a day. And we have all these sort of statistics and stuff. But when it comes down to those real practicalities like that, when you're talking to Palestinians in Gaza, and you say, oh, can you, you know, get me this? Because, you know, we work with writers mm-hmm. in Gaza, writers and photographers in Gaza as well. And they always say, you know, oh, yeah, I can do it as soon as I get electricity kind of thing. And that was a part at the beginning of your film that really hit me as well. When I forget his name now, but the really impoverished gentleman with a large family who, you know, he couldn't even feed his family properly. Due to the siege, the imposition, the shortages of the siege, and he was lighting his house through candlelight because of the lack of electricity during the day.
Exactly, that was Ahmad Sabo, and you know he actually is taking care of two families, and yeah, I mean something that he says really stuck with me, where he said electricity is as important as the air we breathe, and people don't really. Understand how important electricity is. You know, it seems like water, of course, is the main crisis, which I think it is, but electricity really is a huge, huge humanitarian crisis. The fact that you can't pump water on the roofs, you know, of these water tanks when you don't have electricity during the day, the fact that you can't freeze or you can't keep food cold, you know, you can't store meat properly. I mean, there's so many things that we just take for granted. And then, of course, when it came to the footage, yeah, I mean, and when I was sending them clips and I was just like, hey, download this and watch this. He's like, I it's going to take us a couple days to even download files this big. And it really did take weeks, over the course of weeks and weeks, to actually finally get all of the footage, and then following up subsequently getting more and more March footage. It was a good 3-month process to actually finally accumulate all of the footage before we were able to really construct the documentary because of the limitations with electricity and internet.
Mm. Talk a little bit about some of the stories you focus on in the film. Especially, I'm thinking about, you know, you focus on the journalists who are at the front lines, as you say. You also focus on the paramedics, and specifically the story of Razan al-Najjar, the young nurse who was murdered by Israeli snipers. Can you talk a little bit about her story, why it was important to focus on her, especially in terms of kind of, you know, confronting the media bias around you know, how the Great March of Return was being talked about and discussed in the corporate mainstream media?
Right. And yeah, we focus a lot on the victims, you know, one who's a youth, early 20s, who was shot in the head for holding a Palestinian flag. And we focused on him because he really debunks that kind of myth that, you know, everyone's, of course, engineered by Hamas, this really dehumanizing, cynical, disgusting propaganda that's deployed to delegitimize and dehumanize Palestinians over and over again by the corporate media and our political establishment. And this young gentleman is just like, yeah, he's like, I went out there to the march, first was shot in the leg, then I went out again, then was shot in the other leg, and then I went out again and was shot in the head. the entire time was just holding a flag, right? Chanting national slogans. Yeah. And he said, and I'm going to go out again. And I go out every week. And I think that really speaks to how it's about, you know, another gentleman, Muhammad, whose leg is amputated now, who had, they had to cut a part of his bone every, you know, week that he wasn't able to travel. And of course, we know that people are collectively punished. Anyone who's a part of the march, they just outright denied their medical permits. And he's pleading that he needs help and he needs to get across. And he says at the beginning of his interview, he says, freedom is in your heart. It's something that everyone wants to feel. And you know, they explain why they're going out there risking life and limb to take part in this mass nonviolent civil disobedience action. You know, we started off with the story of Ahmad Sabow because we wanted to kind of zero in on one family's struggles. Someone who was also shot at the march, someone who lost their farm due to Israeli bombardment, and end with the story of Razan al-Najjar after we kind of go through this broad view of statistics, which of course is very important because, you know, we're talking about directed, targeted killings of all these protected categories in the Geneva Conventions and, you know, using exploding bullets and toxic gas, and all of these things are banned, of course, internationally. And then we wrapped up the story, the whole documentary with Razan. And a lot of people probably would ask why. You know, Razan is one of the people who made international news. There was a lot of outcry about her death. But what is missed about that is that she was smeared relentlessly. There was no apologies or atonement on behalf of the Israeli government. Certainly no responsibility taken for her death, right? I mean, we know there was many admissions saying every shot was directed, you know, we know where every bullet landed, that with that tweet. Yep. And we know that these people are authorized by generals and, you know, that these shots are very deliberate. These people have a wide view of the demonstrations and it's just completely bullshit to say that their views are obfuscated and people are dying on accident. But Razan's story is very unique because the New York Times interviewed her, you know, I think a couple weeks before she was shot and profiled her. You know, as this young feminist medic, incredible humanitarian, she was the first female to actually go out to the Great March of Return. And that's huge. I mean, she's changing society on the ground. And she has kind of an attitude in her, you know, when she's interviewed, she's just like, I dare you to find anyone with the courage that I did, that I had when I went out there. Just like, and when her colleagues are retelling her story in the last moments of her life, the attitude really shines through where, you know, her colleague, Rasha is just like, yeah, she wanted to take photos of all of us. And I was saying, don't take photos. And she's like, I'm going to take photos whether you like it or not. Like that kind of just like, I don't care what you say. But what was incredible is that after, you know, the reason that we wanted to give true homage to her story and bring the viewers with her at her last moments, and that was all exclusive footage shot from all of their cell phones of what happened to her during her last moments and, you know, how disingenuous the story really is about what happened to her. Because after she was shot, the New York Times did a follow-up kind of true crime investigation of her death. And they kind of recounted this video footage and cell phone cam to basically say she was shot accidentally. And I found that really abhorrent that they went out of their way to really excuse her murder, right? After you see them going to the fence to try to help those two injured civilians and they are shot. I mean, warning shots were fired at them then and they all had their hands raised. They're all wearing medics uniforms and they retreated dozens of yards back behind the fence before they were actually shot. And this is after they were rendered unconscious from that toxic gas, which we still don't know what it is. But it really shows you that they knew exactly who they were. They were targeting them the whole time. And then they finally decided, let's kill them. And this is what another medic talks about, Mohammed Mekdad, who says for the first 6 weeks, it was normal, quote unquote normal, if you could call what was going on normal. He says, you know, shot with gas, targeted with gas. And he said, and then on May 14th, the medics started being killed systematically. And you kind of see the PTSD kind of overcome him as he's retelling this story. But it wasn't just, of course, the New York Times that smeared her and tried to excuse and absolve what happened to Razan. It was the IDF, of course. You know, it was absolutely vile that they had the audacity to put out a propaganda video calling her a human shield and
That's
and
right.
and maliciously editing this video that she gave with Turkish media where she says, I'm Razan Alnajar, I'm a human shield on the front lines, and then they cut it. And if you see the whole video, you see the whole video, just like any combat medic would say, she says, I'm a human shield protecting the wounded and injured with my body. Like, I am there to protect the injured and save their lives. And the fact that they would maliciously doctor that and pretend like she's saying she's a human shield for Hamas is beyond sick. It is beyond reprehensible. And that's what they did to smear her, in her death. And not and so we felt like it was crucial. It was crucial to kind of amplify her story and to give a true tribute to who she was, let her family speak, on her behalf, the true humanitarian hero she really was, and leave people with her legacy to be inspired by her humanitarian work.
Your film does a really good job of debunking these fabrications by Israel. And like you said, they are really disgusting. They were really beyond the pale, but quite typical of Israel. I think that your film is, like I said, your film's titled Gaza Fights for Freedom, and it does a really good job of centering the Palestinian struggle in the Gaza Strip and how it... you did a really good job of rallying the facts and statistics too, but you bring it down to a human level where you've centered the fact that the people in the Gaza Strip for the last, we're getting on for nearly 2 years now, since March 30th, 2018, have risen up in mass protests for the right of return to their homes in historic Palestine, present-day Israel, and against the siege of Gaza and against Israel's injustices and racism. And in response, they've just been shot down dead by Israeli snipers systematically. And my favourite part of the film is there's this central sequence where you put together a sort of collage of... Israeli and pro-Israeli propagandists, mostly on US television, but also one I noticed, LBC London radio station, where the Israeli ambassador was given his usual nonsense. We're not supposed to swear on this podcast. you put these sequences together really effectively, and I was watching it, and my blood pressure was sort of rising, and I was thinking, this is the usual crap. But you did a really good job of debunking it, because instead of then saying, you coming in as a narrator and say, well, actually, this is what happens, and this is why, you very simply and effectively just showed this footage. Shocked. So they're all smearing the demonstrators as, like you said, human shields for terrorists, or terrorist sympathizers, Hamas and so on and so forth, all this stuff. And then you contrast that just by no narration, just showing the footage shot by Palestinians who are actually on the ground at these demonstrations, as they started as they've been all along, as peaceful, unarmed demonstrations, non-violent resistance, right? Which is what Western liberals always claim that they want Palestinians to do, to renounce.
If only they held peaceful marches like Gandhi did.
Exactly. So I really loved that part, especially. I mean, it was obviously horrific as well, just because of the nature of what it showed. But I just found that a really effective central part of it.
Thank you. I mean, I did that intentionally. I edited together that montage, because it's just, when you put it together, it's really beyond the pale, and beyond belief that this propaganda is actually believed, and widely distributed, and it's deployed by these officials who look like me, who sound like me, and it's directed toward an American audience, and the cartoons, these Hasbro cartoons that Israel puts out, are also directed towards an American audience. And the propaganda is is so atrocious. I mean, the fact that they say they're committing self-genocide. You know, the fact that
was grotesque. Right. That was Natalie Bennett.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The fact that they're
Israeli politician.
That they want telegenically dead Palestinians for their cause. I mean, the more dead, the better. That they're literally throwing civilians in the line of fire. And I like that you picked up on that, Asa, because I like that you picked up on how I didn't have to narrate anything. There was nothing to weave together other than that child at the march who says, "We're here to liberate Palestine so we can all live in peace." And when you see that, you know, really young girl, I think she's like 10 or something like that, just really eloquently stating why she's participating at the march. And then you see these contingents of women leading the march. And as Ahmed Abu Artema said, you know, back to the Gandhi thing, he's like, yeah, people say, where's the Palestinian Gandhi? He's like, there's been 200 of them. They've all been killed. And what do you want us to do? And he, you know, he clearly articulates that it was a peaceful action and that it was all symbolic, kind of akin to like an Occupy Wall Street where they wanted to pitch tents in the open land and mount pressure from the international community to draw attention to their struggle as refugees 70 years later. And it's just really beautifully poetic how he weaves together the intentions of the march. And also when you see for yourself that although there are political parties represented, and we know that there's a mosaic of political factions in Gaza, the march was led by unaffiliated academics, poets, artists, and activists. And you see kind of it was like this festive celebration. And again, like a lot of women and a lot of young children chanting. And that one young girl who says, you know, when an ant defeats an elephant. And I love that part. It's just people that you never see and voices that you never hear from.
Abby, you invited me to the San Francisco screening of the film last month, and it was brilliant to watch. But what struck me about the audience is that I overheard several people talking about how they were just now learning about Palestine and were eager to see footage that you had put into this film because it contradicted the mainstream narrative, even in progressive or leftist spaces. What do you hope audiences get out of watching this documentary?
Right. And we took the documentary on a North American tour because we didn't just want to put it up on Vimeo. And we're putting up the Arabic version actually in about a week. And we're actually making it more widely accessible. After the tour is over next week. But when we took it on the North American tour, it was for a very specific intent. It was to link with Palestinian solidarity organizations, of course, Jewish Voices for Peace as well, and other activist groups, anti-war groups, to mobilize a movement, to resurrect an anti-war movement, to galvanize people against the U.S. empire, which is subsidizing these atrocities and kind of sponsoring what is happening in our names. And we wanted an audience to leave empowered, and we wanted an audience to leave with tools of action. And that's why we, you know, not only sponsored these screenings and had this Q&A session afterward to really generate that movement and the call to action, but also we wanted to frame the entire documentary in an incontrovertible construct of international law violations that really left the viewer with completely armed with knowledge that they are, that they feel empowered to now, they can argue with anyone, they can crush this debate. I mean, this is really a political education effort, as we know. I mean, we're massively ignorant in this country, and we're conditioned from birth to just hate Palestinians and dehumanize brown people in general, and also to just have American exceptionalism, which is a toxic sickness. So I think it's really important, first and foremost, to be armed with this knowledge and to be secure in the information, where you're not swayed by the propaganda, where you can go into leftist circles and say, no, you're not progressive if you don't support Palestinians. No, you're not progressive if you're not advocating BDS. And we need to be really confident in that. And that's why we had this construct of international law, because even though the UN has its faults, you know, I disagree with a lot of the things that the UN does, but I know for the average American viewer, that's something that they kind of hold, you know, they hold the UN as kind of this high court. And it's important to understand that all of these things that Israel is doing in the confines of international law is illegal and unjust. And everything the Palestinians are doing is completely legal, necessary, and justified. And that includes, I mean, as the UNGA National Assembly of 1978 articulates, that they do have the right to resist in an armed struggle against colonial and foreign occupation. But that's not even what the Great March is. But I think it's important for people to know and understand that this is, you know, these international law violations are completely egregious, grievous. And the only thing that is preventing Israel from being held accountable on the world stage is the U.S.'s veto power at the U.N. Security Council. And so it has to come back to us mounting that movement here and, you know, forming some sort of resistance against this government.
I just wanted to just reiterate again that I thought it was, I think your film was brilliant. I think it's one of the most important films about Palestine since John Pilger's Palestine Is Still the Issue, which is, you know, one of my favourite films of all time. And it's still sadly relevant,
timeless.
You know.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought it was a wonderful film. You did a really good job. And all our listeners should go and buy it or rent it immediately. So thank you very much, Abby, for coming on the show.
Wow, that's... I'm incredibly honored to hear that. I can't thank you enough for that compliment. And Nora, I respect your work so much. You've both had a profound impact on me. And, you know, it's really important that we stand together and keep fighting. And people can check it out at GazaFightsForFreedom.com. We also have DVDs up for sale now. So thank you so much for the opportunity. And I'm really honored to be on. Thanks so much again.
Oh, thank you so much, Abby. Abby Martin, you're a longtime journalist and TV host of The Empire Files, and of course the producer and director of Gaza Fights for Freedom. Thank you so much for all that you do and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast. We'll have you back on really soon. Thanks so much, Abby. And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.